The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 3rd of May, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Jerry Brandon, Chief Executive Officer of Integumin. The ticker there is SKIN. And Jerry explains the business model, the progress he's achieved since taking control, and the potential going forward. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the global economy and the following stocks: Franchise Brands, Zitronic, and Persimmon. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of these lists, both these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a host of other content, including three AIM companies taking a slice of a $1 trillion defense spending pie. That's an article there. That's the featured article. Zach, looking at stocks, taking stock then 3rd of May. Also, Tech Capital's guidance celebrates Florida legalizes self-driving cars. By the way, if you use the Vox Markets app, of course, it's free to use and download, and you get RNS notifications straight to the front screen of your phone, plus you can see your watch list on there and all that stuff, then please do, if you've got a few spare minutes, go to Apple and give us a review and a five-star rating if you could, and that way other people will find it easy to download that, and when they're searching for investment apps, ours will pop up hopefully in their search, in top five search. Thanks so much for that. By the way, don't forget, all that content I talked about is at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Are you tired of missing news about stock market companies you follow? The Vox Markets app helps investors stay ahead by making sure you never miss an important update. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jerry Brandon, Chief Executive Officer of Integumin, and the ticker there is SKIN. Jerry, thanks for joining me.
Morning, Justin. Very nice to be here.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I interviewed the previous CEO of SKIN, even from the IPO days, and from then I said, SKIN, to me, one of the things you need to have, I think, is a memorable sort of ticker. And that is a good ticker, because you are in the game of SKIN, you know?
Yeah, it covers everything, literally.
Yeah, I know. Jerry, so listen, I've had a lot of people DM me saying, get these guys on the podcast, or you should look into this stock. It's going to the sky. And I thought, I know it's been restructured. There's a lot of good vibes around you and what you're doing. Before we get into the detail of it, Jerry, for people not familiar with Integumin, could you summarise what you're all about, please?
Sure. We're a digital and physical alternative to animal cruelty-free testing services. Basically, we prove the impact of skincare product claims for healthcare, life science, clinical research, pharma, and cosmetic industry. Effectively, we replace the use of animals in laboratories for real laboratory-grown human skin. And that provides all sort of safety tests, etc., for acne, eczema, psoriasis, anti-aging, all the rage. We all don't want to go old. That companies are required before they actually launch on the market. I mean, it's a pretty big market, estimated to be about $10 billion, and 3D skin industry should reach $1 billion by about 2020. Now, according to analysts out there, really, but that's basically the bottom line of what we're doing.
Yeah, let's be honest. It's a massive market, isn't it? From cosmetic to issues with, your skin, like anything from eczema, all that kind of stuff. But it's a massive market. And do you know when I first interviewed in a previous guise, of course, I did think the lab skin part of you, animal-free testing, that was the way forward. And so, yeah. First of all, can you give us your background, Jerry, and where have you come from to be involved right now?
Okay, yeah. A bit of a veteran. I actually listed a company back in 2001, Ultracell Pharmaceuticals. That was also a skin and wound care company. So I understood exactly what the gem inside of Integumin was before I got involved. Because back in 2002, I had to spend a couple of $100,000 proving to Boots chemists before we got our product on the shelf that it actually does exactly what we claim it does. Not the old, run sealed, does what it says on the tin. Nobody believes you until you have absolute proof. So this company back in 2000 and And two, once we actually got it onto the shelf, we went from zero to 33 million in less than 3 years, 43 countries. So basically, the proof of the pudding is actually getting sure that it does what we wanted to actually do. So now here was actually a piece of technology that they were selling for about £2,000 in kit form to research to research departments inside of the actual skincare companies, and they were testing it for safety and efficacy, but nothing really to actually show that it has the impact to change the bacteria on your skin. Now, I knew that instead of £2,000, having cost me £200,000, if we only charged £50,000, they'd be saving £150,000. Yes. So that's what actually got me so excited about this. And I think the actual biggest problem was that it was originally designed for scientists, by scientists, for scientists. It was bought by accountants when it was actually part of the larger integument before I got my hands on it. And it was never fully integrated and never fully utilized and never fully understood by the people that were sitting around the table. So, timing is actually the most important thing here for me. So that's why I jumped in.
So LabSkin, take us through how it works, you know, who uses it and how you derive money from that then. How does it work?
Okay, it's a very straightforward process. We grow it from cells, human cells, in a laboratory. It actually ends up being roughly the size of a 50 pence piece, and they put products. They actually take a swab of your skin. Whatever actually disease or bacteria or virus is actually on your skin, whether it's acne or eczema or dermatitis, etc. They continue to grow it for a couple of days. Then they apply the treatment or the product or the testing product that they actually want to test and see the effect of their product or the impact of their product on the skin itself. Because it's all fully automated in digital form, we're able to then show the client what the bacteria is growing, what bacteria is dying, and the impact of the product they actually have. Now, normally you'd have volunteers that would come in, you know, the human volunteers would come in and test, but you'd need, you know, 64% of 280 people that would say that, oh yeah, this had a great effect. Well, we can scientifically prove it actually does have this effect or that effect. So it's a unique delivery for the marketing department of these large cosmetic and skincare companies that wasn't there before. So this is all the big growth factor for us.
Yeah, so where are you at the moment? So you said there, you kept mentioning they, so I assume that there are clients, and you just mentioned the pharmaceutical companies. So who are your clients generally?
Who are the clients? Okay, well, again, the funny part about this is that Evocutis was the company before it was even bought by Integument. Mm-hmm. And over that period of time, they had built up a clientele of 35 major corporations. And of those, the CEO previous to me, they had even mentioned that Unilever was a client. Mm-hmm. Now, these are the who's who of cosmetic global corporations. Mm-hmm. So these are already clients of ours. We're already approved suppliers of products and now services into those clients. So we've gone from selling them £2,000 kits up to £55,000 and £65,000 worth of services. So for the same basic technology, except that we as a third party provide them verification, validation, and certification that their product actually does this, this, or this.
Yeah.
So it's a big, big leap, and that's why actually the transformation of the company, when I picked it up in August of last year, ended up doing 350% increase in sales in the second half of 2018. Mm. It's a complete transformation, Justin.
Yeah, and first of all, is that growth going to continue? And also, what's the alternative? These big companies, say, so now your price point has gone up, what's the alternative for them to test their products? Where else can they do it?
Well, you know, in the EU, in 2013, they changed the rules a big time. And they actually just said that no product or no ingredient that's going to be tested on skin can be tested on animals. And, you know, like it or not, still, but you know, 2017, according to RSPCA, there were still 27,000 animals tested in the UK alone for skincare and cosmetic products. So, you know, but it is dying out very, very rapidly. And again, timing, as I said to you earlier, and this is actually crucial. So, the alternatives then are bring in human volunteers. So you bring in 40, 50, 100 volunteers, focus group, they apply it over 2 weeks, and then they come back with their 97 questions. And that's where you see on the TV advertisements of 284 women, 76% of them said that they would recommend it to their friend or use it again, such and such and such. Yeah. That's not actual claims. That's not capable of showing the impact that you could have previously when you had animals testing. But now when you've actually got human skin in the laboratory that you can grow bacteria on, that you can grow viruses on, that you can even grow diseases on, and then test it, now they've actually got their mojo back again. There's a new claim inside of the actual drugstore's shelves to say, if you improve the good and bad bacteria balance on your skin, then there's every likelihood that your skin condition is actually going to, you know, come out better. You can't say it's cured, but you know, in the industry, from an investor's perspective and from the actual company's perspective, nobody wants a cure. They want you to be suffering from chronic disease that can keep you actually, you know, balanced and therefore fine and buying it every month. Yeah. That's not my issue. That's their issue. And, you know, companies don't actually make money by curing you.
No, exactly. So these big companies, the alternative for them is actually do it with real humans. And I suppose that's more costly. It takes a longer time. It's not as flexible, like you said. So what's to stop them, for example? Like, you've got LabSkin. What protection has LabSkin got? What's to stop them doing what you've done with LabSkin?
Okay.
Why wouldn't they do that, you know?
Well, you know, this is actually taking 11 years of development.
Okay.
So these large corporations, like any pharmaceutical corporation, nobody actually has internal clinical research. Mm-hmm. It's all about external verification and certification, because everybody wants checks and balances. And that's the way the EU regulations are going. That's the way the FDA has actually gone, and is continuing to move forward to separate out the responsibility of verification to third parties who are, you know, certified and regulated. That means you actually just can't have, you know, the guys inside of a large corporation. Again, I just mentioned one company, Unilever. They would actually have their own laboratories. But, you know, if I come along and actually say, hey, our product is actually wonderful, it does this, this, and this, it's an awful lot better if you have saying on your documentation that independent research has proven that blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And that's where this is actually going. It doesn't actually make any sense for them to do that, because they'd still have to go and have someone verify us and certify us and regulate us. So, again, we're just right in the middle of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you mentioned that the market's big there, and you've mentioned you've improved revenues by over 300% there. So going forward, what's the potential here? What size, as an investor looking at it, you thinking, how big can you get here?
Well, if my no man is listening and Aim is listening, you know, of course I can't do that. But what I could say is, in 2017, they did a turnover of 238,000. I have already set out an RNS and on the 7th of January that by the end of 2018, we'd more than doubled that turnover, of which the vast majority of that is, you know, basically 70% of that is actually in the second half, the last 4 months when I actually jumped in. And again, I actually said at the beginning of 2019, our orders were much larger than the entire turnover of 2017. The trend is actually going in the right way from the physical side.
Yeah, yeah.
And since we've actually acquired RhinoCloud on the digital side, so we've fully automated recurring revenue models as well in addition. Again, we only announced that closing of that just this last month. In the first quarter of the year, their turnover alone, just for digital in this space, was just under 200,000. So the trend between 2017 and 2018 physically is certainly going in the right direction in 2019. And then we bolted on RhinoCloud. And in the first quarter alone, as they actually started to come in with us, they actually added in 200,000. So, you know, and have said going forward that they would actually be increasing as well. And 2019 looks pretty good for us. That's a complete difference to what it was last year.
Yeah, absolutely. So, in fact, you mentioned RhinoCloud. Take us through, because I was reading about, obviously, LabSkin. I understand that. Then I saw the RNS for RhinoCloud. I thought, okay, what is this? How does this? What is RhinoCloud? How does it fit into this? What is it all about? Sure. Take us through it.
Well, back in September, I first met Finn. I've known him for a number of years, but I first met him in relation to this. Finn Murray, being the managing director of Rhinocloud and now sales group sales director for Integumen. What we looked for when we were ramping up the sales of Labskin was not just have the physical side of it, but to fully automate the actual process. Because as we went from physical production of test kits and selling to services, obviously there's more manpower required in actually those services. So by automating it, there's obviously less manpower required for an automation process. We realized then the data transmission back to the clients could be done in real time, so that no matter where the tests are carried out, in our laboratories or any other laboratories around the world, we could actually have the client view in real time what's actually happening on the skin in the laboratories. So that has become a whole automation system where the client has a remote microbiology department, basically with Labskin, as opposed to their huge investment that they would have inside of their company because of the new rules that have actually come out. So that's where this all, you know, fell in to the right time, right people, right place, right company. And we agreed to acquire them back in January. They were going to do a Series A round, but we convinced them that would be best to actually come in line with us. They get access to the 35 major corporate clients that we have. We get access to an already built platform that they actually built over the last 2 years. So it's perfect for us because we built the platform itself before we acquired it, as opposed to raising the money and then pouring it into a hole, not knowing what it's actually going to be like. That's finished. We're in a situation where we're now generating revenue from something that's already built, and we bought it for that purpose. It's accretive to the actual company's revenues.
Yeah, absolutely. And is anyone doing, you know, I mean, do you have any major competitors out there then?
I suppose, you know, asking those questions to Uber and to Airbnb at the time, how do you answer that? You know, they were actually leveraging assets that they didn't own and delivering through a digital format to their clients access to those assets. What we've actually got is not that much different, because we can leverage the automation of any assets of any laboratory or any service provider, any university, and we have a number of universities, directly to the client, so the client can actually get access to equipment that they don't actually ever have to own, but be state of the art. Effectively, in the middle, we provide the actual digital transfer, but also have an artificial intelligence background to allow the client see the comparison of 40 years of patents, 15 years of scientific publications in relation to what it is that they're actually doing. So the client actually gets far more detail and access to equipment than they've ever had. The service providers, through us as approved suppliers into these large corporations that have been built over the last 5 years, get access to these large corporations that they would never have access to, because no large corporation would give an approved level status to a university or innovator or even a small company. There's a whole 18-month to two-year process to get on their approved list. Because we're already on their approved list, we become the platform and share revenues from both sides. So we get revenues from the client, and we also get divided shared revenues from the service providers as well. Again, that's a new area of value for us. And by accident, you know, we stopped selling the equipment to people before they actually had Labskin certification, because, you know, why give somebody something that they don't actually know anything about? So we actually required them to be certified. So every university student that actually wants to use Labskin has to be certified by us. They got to come in, they got to pay for that service, then they go back with the certification, and, you know, when you think about it, they then go outside of the university into their new employer, they're Labskin certified, and what are they going to say to their client? Or their employer, you got to use Labskin. So they become ambassadors. They actually pay us to become ambassadors for the actual Labskin. It's a huge ecosystem. Looking at the Salesforce.com model, where our system is basically the platform and others build in and tap in. So I actually, you know, mentioned it in an RNS recently that it was, with the the laboratory equivalent of Airbnb. So
yeah, wow. So I see, obviously, Labskin is the big thing here, but you've got some other kind of products here. I mean, you've got your own sort of cosmetic range or skincare range. So what other products do you have, or are you now sort of, you know, getting rid of those, or are you carrying on with that?
Oh, I've cleaned out all of the non-performing assets that were in there. And because of that, it has allowed me to eliminate about £2 million of debt. There was also a litigation issue that came about in September of last year. We've got that settled completely. And, you know, we saved forward liabilities of about £500,000 by actually doing so. Mm-hmm. We also, and again, this is something in relation to my belief that, you know, I need to bring everybody forward with me, because when I got in there, there was no money. There was no money, no credits, nothing. So my other company, Cellulac, and myself and my CFO, Camilla Slover, we put in between ourselves and the company about $1.5 million of debt and equity. So, you know, talking about skin in the game, we're definitely actually got skin in the game here. Now, and because we put it in debt, we could have actually bought this, because bearing in mind, as I said to you, the situation was at the beginning of 2018, they were considering selling this because they didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. We put in debt, which meant we didn't dilute when it was actually down at 0.45 of a cent. When it actually got to 1.5, then we converted the debt. So we could have massively multiplied the amount of equity that we had in this company back then, but we waited until it was actually up at 3.5 times what we originally actually put that debt in. That's now in a situation where the balance sheet is very healthy. We have hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of equipment that was actually part of this. We eliminated all of the legacy debt, all of the legacy professional advisor costs that have been associated, even back as far as the IPO in 2017. It's now squeaky clean. And the money that was actually brought in is our fuel for growth. So a lot of that money is actually going to go into the sales and marketing to grow further our client base and extend that revenue per client by adding these extra services.
Yeah. And so going forward, I mean, obviously you can't mention anything that hasn't been announced officially, but mm-hmm. what's the next big milestone you're hoping to achieve then, Jared?
Well, you know, in 2017, another EU regulation required that any skincare product that has access to, you know, orifice elements and you know, whether it's female hygiene products, nasal products, oral products, ears even, they all actually have to have skin testing. Now, normally you'd actually have to have, you know, 100 people testing that. Well, with the lab skin, the model that we actually have figured out is that we can reduce the number of volunteers, human volunteers, and therefore the cost in half, mm-hmm. by actually taking a swab from the same volunteer and using a parallel lab skin with it. So effectively, we're going to be moving into the CRO space to actually satisfy some of the new EU regulations, half the price for the client, new business for us, more revenue per client, and it's basically all into the exact same clients that are already there. So our marketing costs are not great in actually doing that. Very exciting aspect of that, and I think 2019... you know, we've just done one acquisition. There's scope for us to actually get access to other underperforming companies and tap into that with our, you know, drop this CRO element into that space and see what comes of it.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, Jared, on the Vox podcast every day, I highlight sort of top 5 most followed companies on Vox. And obviously, to get in that list, you have lots of people hitting your follow button. So right now, in summary, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not yet following the story, could you give them 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please?
Well, the trend of sales since I actually got on board with my team has gone up exponentially from even from the first half of 2017 to 2018 to the second half of 2018. That trend continues to actually move forward. As far as skin in the game is concerned, I don't know how many CEOs and their management have actually put in $1.5 million into a company that at the time we actually got involved had a market cap of $1.5 million. We did that with debt, so therefore we didn't massively dilute. We want our investors to come along with us. This is a big project for me. I've done multiple ones before in Cellulac. You can go on cellulac.com. You can have a look at what I did there. They had 10 times their return between 2012 and 2015. Previously, Ultracell Pharmaceutical, 0 to 33 million in 3 years. Now, that's no proof that going forward it's actually going to be, you know, a success. But on the basis of 20 years of experience, knowing what I actually bought, why I wanted to buy it, and where we're going, I think it's worth a follow.
Excellent stuff. Jared, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Looking forward to it, Justin. Thanks very much for taking us.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You're Russ.
I'm very well, Justin. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. In fact, I saw quite a helpful graphic, I think, punched out by AJ Bell on Twitter about if you want to become an investor, you know, where to start, things to look out for. And that's always good.
What we're here to do, try and help. So.
Yeah, because I always think that it's a minefield for new people, because I always think it's really bad it's not taught in schools investing.
I think that's shocking. Absolutely.
I learned about Pythagoras' theorem. I don't know where I've ever used that since school. I never really learned about mortgages or anything like that, or interest rates. And I'm just thinking, people are putting, if they've got spare money, their money in the bank, they, what a waste that is, really, you know? It's not even beating inflation, is it?
Not at all. The concept of real returns on money seems completely lost on a lot of people, which is just completely wrong.
And there are things like, you know, tracker funds. There are equities and they're risk, but they're relatively safe, these big tracker funds that can give you a nice dividend or whatever, and it's a lot safer than just, productive than just putting it in a bank, you know?
We spend a lot of time, we don't provide advice, but we do provide a lot of educational work for retail investors and also for financial advisors, for that matter, because they're, you know, busy people, time pressed, just keeping on top of all the tax and pension rules keeps them busy, let alone financial markets. That's what we're here to do. But I actually do spend quite a bit of my own time, you know, if parents in my adopted hometown of Brighton say, we got a careers week, can you come in and talk about financial markets to the boys and girls? And I will do so when I can and just explain to them concepts like, you know, what financial markets are for, compounding, mortgages and all of those things. So, but yeah, it should be taught, and it constantly baffles me that it isn't.
I remember Buffett saying once he passes away, he would put all his money in S&P tracker, and if you just literally put your money in S&P tracker and topped up, you know, once a year, once a quarter, and done nothing else for many, many years, you've done very well, you know, and your returns would be quite nice, so compounding that, and yet put in a bank account for 0.5% interest or whatever it is, so it's ridiculous.
We know there's going to be swings and roundabouts. We've had a 10-year bull market, and at some stage you'd expect it to be a stumble, but over the long term, it has so far been the correct thing to do.
Talking about inflation now, Mark Carney, he's the most I tell you what, he's not, I don't think he's winning any popularity vote at the moment. I mean, cause he's changed his mind.
He's only got the jobs till January now,
he said now apparently interest rate increases could be more frequent than expected if the economy performs, and the bank have now upgraded the growth from 1.5 this year, revised up from February's forecast of 1.2, which is quite a big jump percentage-wise for an economy, isn't it? So, why is he saying this? What do you think he's saying?
Well, I think some of it is partly, you know, Brexit's been postponed by 6 months. You've seen some stockpiling ahead of the 31st of March, and, you know, that has probably inflated the short-term numbers a little bit, so there'll be some mechanical element to it. On the face of it, the US economy came in a lot stronger than people thought in the first quarter. You've got China, in theory, putting in some stimulus. So there'll be a different range of factors there. I think Mr. Carney's problem is that, you know, he is now seen as the boy who's cried wolf. In that, you know, yes, he has increased interest rates twice in the last 2 or 3 years, but he has actually promised, you know, a lot, and with, you know, abandoned forward guidance. And he's talked a lot about interest rates are going to rise much more quickly than you think, you know. And in the end, they haven't. And I think that's now a bit of a credibility gap for him and the Bank of England. He's only got the job until January, and his successor, whoever it happens to be, has probably got a little bit of work to do there. And I think I can see where Mr. Carney's coming from. You know, wage growth is now running at 3.5% against headline inflation of 1.8, 1.9. Mm-hmm. Unemployment is at a 40-odd year low. So you can see why you would start to get some increases in inflation. And also, let's face it, central banks have not been raising interest rates. They're seemingly letting the economy run that little bit hotter. So again, you would logically perhaps expect inflation to come through. Now, we haven't seen that really for the last 10 years. I think what did catch my eye, and please, this is not to in any way take the mickey, we all get things wrong. Mm-hmm. There was a Bloomberg Business Week front cover the other week, basically saying the death of inflation with a dead dinosaur on the front. Mm-hmm. Now, fine, you know, but whenever I see anything like that, it automatically makes me think of the Economist cover from 1998, drowning in oil when oil was $10, and they were saying it would never go above that, and that didn't work out. And it reminds me of the Business Week cover from 1978, the death of equities, why inflation are killing stocks. Mm-hmm. And within 2 years, the biggest bull market in history had begun. So when people start, I think it's just a natural temptation to extrapolate from your recent experiences, 5, 10 years even, and assume that it's never going to change. And the world just doesn't work that way. So I'm automatically getting, you know, more intrigued by inflation just because people are telling me, forget it, there isn't going to be any. So I'm not saying Mr. Carney's wrong, but what I am saying is that he's just said this so often, people have kind of switched off. It's like being a parent, right? Yeah. You know, you say to the child, if you don't do this, I'm going to take all your toys away. And you don't do it because you don't want to be a bad dad or a bad mum, do you? And eventually they stop listening. So, and I think it's kind of the same thing. People have just slightly tuned out. And, you know, I think economic growth is okay. I mean, it's what did strike me as bizarre was that people were disappointed on Wednesday that the Federal Reserve didn't promise them an interest rate cut this year. Mm-hmm. It's like, pardon?
Yeah.
You know, again, wage growth is accelerating, unemployment is low, GDP growth is acceptable. Under normal circumstances, the Fed would be raising interest rates. It isn't, because I think it's got the President of the United States breathing all over its neck ahead of next year's general election, because US GDP isn't running at its 4% target. And also, I think it is genuinely worried by that market carnage we saw late last year, how very moderate increases in monetary policy created financial market carnage. And you can see how US consumer confidence and the S&P 500 seem to correlate. Now, which is the chicken and which is the egg? I don't know. But you could argue that we're just one decent bear market away from, you know, severe financial difficulty, because there's a lot of debt in the system, as we know. Yeah. And I think the Fed is having to tread very carefully. Interest rate cuts? Now, I mean, if they were to cut interest rates, now they certainly aren't looking at inflation or employment, which are their two main mandates. So that would be a dead giveaway. It would tell you they're either looking at what's coming out of the White House or what's going on their dealing screens, and I'm not sure either of those is healthy for the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? I read somewhere, and I forget where it was, but it stuck in my head. And it said, whenever you have a systemic sort of collapse of an economy, or and it goes wrong, and you go into a bear market like we did with the financial crash, or going back to the Great Depression, it takes around 10 years for normalcy to come back and revert to mean in inflation and all that stuff. So it's not unusual, apparently, to take about 10 years for it to get back to normal, you know? So
I can believe it.
Mm. So anyway, so we're round about that point now.
I think we're there, because in the end, you know, don't forget, it's only, just over 10 years since people were queuing up outside Northern Rock to try and get their money back.
Yeah, horrible.
Okay?
Yeah,
and horrible, horrible time for everybody. Mm. Where are we now? Oh, yeah. Let's give a loss-making ride-sharing service that may never make a profit a $90 billion valuation.
Yeah, I know. And some of them are saying, we'll probably never make money anyway.
And to be fair, people who went to the presentations and have read the prospectus, and I've read a lot of the prospectus and I got bored, the one word that never cropped up in it was profit.
Yeah. And do you know, whenever I'm looking at small caps and I'm looking at turnarounds or companies going towards commercial, I do a control F and I look for profit or break even. The intention to get there, at least, you know, to make print in print.
It just doesn't seem to be part of the agenda at the moment. Yeah, and in the long run, it's cash flow that drives valuations, not press releases or customer numbers.
Yeah, exactly. It's just trading off the hype, aren't they? Let's look at actual individual stocks then, Russ.
Yes, a couple of small caps. One that we've looked at before, which is Zitronic, and one that we haven't, which is Franchise Brands. And then at Income, I'd like to talk about Persimmon. simmon
today. Yes. Do you know what I tweeted out, actually? It was a couple. I don't know where they were. I think the Midlands somewhere. They bought a persimmon house.
No.
They've had so many snags with it. They bought a 6-foot poster and put it on the front of their house as a new site they'd built, persimmons. And do not buy a house in this site until you talk to us. And so, of course, persimmons try and deal with that now, but it seems like a bit late
for some
couples.
We'll come on to that.
Yeah, so franchise brands.
Franchise brands. FRAN, 70 million market cap. Macclesfield headquartered company, and as the name rather suggests, it owns franchise companies, and it makes money by charging franchisees startup fees, license fees, and a percentage of their sales. Now, it's got four or five different businesses. The biggest one is Metro Rod, which is a drain unblocker. It's also got a plumbing business, Metro Plum, a business called Chips Away, which is the name might give you leads to believe is a car body repair work business, and then Barking Mad, a dog sitting service. So it's a bit of an interesting, some would say random mix. There's a couple of other businesses in there that are due to be sold. I think what's initially interesting about this is it's run by Stephen Helmsley, who was CEO of Domino's Pizza for a long time, one of the biggest franchising companies, still chairman, I believe, one of the biggest franchising players. And it's backed by both him and Nigel Ray, serial entrepreneur and big Domino's investor. They've got more than half of the equity between them. It's got very limited debt. It's looking to invest heavily in IT, in marketing, to organically grow these businesses. Might be the odd acquisition there as well, you never know. And Mr. Helmsley's actually said, you know, I went to a presentation he gave, you know, he's looking to get Metro Rod to be a £100 million revenue business. Well, the whole group's only 35 right now, so there's no shortage of ambition here. Mm-hmm. It's in the black already, pays a small dividend already. And so, you know, there looks to be pretty strong momentum in the business, and the recent trading statement was fine. Clearly, the issue with any franchise business, and this is always the biggest risk, is when things start to go well, do the franchisees start demanding a bigger share of the pie? And you've seen that at Domino's right now. They're actually in dispute, you know, looking for a bigger share of the pizza on that occasion. And so that is always your big challenge for management. The yield is less than 1%, so it's not one for income players, but it is going to be one where I think you could get some positive news momentum-wise and in terms of the business over the next few months and years.
Yeah, when you got two guys like that, Ray and this guy, Stephen, they're both excellent sort of track records, you know, really well-off guys. And they, you know, you've got to look at it, I think. I've just added it to my watch list just to see what they're doing with it, because I think it's very interesting. So, how bad can these guys fail? That's what I think. Because
Domino's Pizza does cast a bit of a cloud, because at the moment there's a lot of franchisee unrest there. But they have made it work before, and you kind of think that they're capable of making it work again.
Yeah, and maybe lessons learned from that as well, you know?
Well,
so
yeah, exactly.
Going forward.
Exactly.
Okay, so what's next, Russ?
So Zytronic, ZYTM, where I've not covered myself in glory. Well, I have once, looked at it initially, made a good turn on it, came back to it after the shares had retreated, and it's not worked out so well this time. Remember, it's a maker of rugged screens, like ATM screens, you know, anything that you can say that needs to withstand a bit of a bashing. It's been a great long-term growth stock. It's a technology leader. There are trends to bigger screens that mean more transistors, which means higher prices and higher margins. And it's got a good long-term consistent dividend record. But as I have pointed out before, you do see volatility in product cycles. They have had four or five dips in annual profit since they floated in 2002. We've got one cycle right now with bank ATMs. They're obviously not making as many screens for those, right? And just 2 weeks before the interims, they doled out a profit warning yesterday, I think, saying that gaming machines have gone slower than. And they said that normally, it's all right, we're having a slow first half. Normally we get a big uptick in the second half. Not so sure this time around. Mm-hmm. And so the stock got taken down by about a quarter yesterday, so it's now gone from £4 since I last looked at it to £2.60. So it's like, oh dear. But they've got £12 million of net cash in the bank. We've seen this before, and they do pay a dividend. Now, they actually increased the dividend a lot last year, so I think their management team were very sensible, have clearly been caught off guard by this. They're saying the interim dividend will be similar to last year's. If they leave an unchanged full year dividend at 22.5p, you've got a yield of nearly 8%. Even if they think that's a little bit zealous, you're still going to get a decent yield out of it with a net cash balance sheet to help you hunker down. It's still in profit, this company. So having made a mess of it, we have at least seen this before. And you'd like to think, if history's any guide, at some stage the cycle will turn and back we go. So take my medicine, sit on it, and suffer for a while.
Yeah.
But it is likely to be dead money now, I think, for some time to come. So if you're impatient and in a hurry, have a think. But if you're prepared to be patient, harvest those dividends and wait. History, if any guide, would lead us to think we'll get back in the end.
Do you know what? I'd like to see the breakdown on the on how much they get from cash point machines, because I think, you know, we've seen the cash, the cash society getting smaller. You know, people want cash.
Yep.
Yeah. So, anyway, do you know what? I remember I did see this. See, every morning I look at the market movers, and this was topping the big faller list, you know, the big losers list.
I looked at my screen yesterday and went, better explain myself to Justin tomorrow.
So, S-Z-Y-T, but then again, you know, it's stock market like a pendulum. It always oversells, overbuys, so who knows?
There we are.
But,
we'll see.
Cool. So Persimmon, let's get
to Persimmon. You've asked me to talk about an income stock every once in a while, so let's look at this one, because it's offering a dividend yield of 10%.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, let's start with that. It's a FTSE 100 company. It's based in my hometown of York rather than my adopted hometown of Brighton. And that yield comes from 110 pence a year ordinary dividend and a 125p special. They paid that last year. They're going to pay it this year. They're going to pay it next year. And then I think in 2021, they've just said at the moment, ordinary dividend. Now, there are lots, I mean, the shares haven't really done much for all of that. And clearly investors are demanding this high yielding compensation for the risks involved. Well, what are the risks? Well, housing market could turn down. Brexit, if you want, you know, There's been a huge ruckus at the company about its pay structure. The previous CEO ended up walking. The chairman walked the plank. And you've got this issue of quality of build. And there are lots, you know, you don't have to look far on social media to find lots of people who are incredibly unhappy with some of the houses they bought from this company. And in a trading statement this week, the new boss did say, we're actually slowing down sales, we're slowing down outlet openings, because we want to make sure we're giving customers the right quality build and there's no snags. Now, you saw exactly the same thing with Bovis, Christmas 2016, and that company's name is still mud with lots of house buyers. Mm-hmm. There was a program on Radio 5 Live just this year, people still saying, we're not living in the house we bought, we're living in one on the same estate because they can't get it right. And so this is, you know, so there are top-down reasons for people not being happy with the company and some bottom-up ones. Now, Bovis has recovered from that very quickly, despite the fact that lots of customers are still unhappy. The company's pulled its finger out. There's been no problems with new estates. There's a possibility for a similar turnaround with Persimmon. And generally, where you have a company that's, you know, unloved and kind of feels embarrassing and makes you feel a bit dirty to own it, it's normally the right thing to do, funnily enough.
Yeah.
So the people are clearly worried, is this dividend sustainable if the housing market turns down? Well, the government's supporting it with Help to Buy up to 2021, so 2022, or even longer now, I think, 2023, so we'll see. And the company does have £1 billion of net cash on its balance sheet. Mm-hmm. This total dividend payout was £735 a year, so they can fund that. They're generating operating profit of £1 billion a year. So again, funding the dividend for the next couple of years should be fine. So if you're purely about income, and I stress purely about income, this may well be one to have a look at. Capital-wise, you know, it's on 8x earnings with a yield of 10. You are paying 2x book value, which is historically top of the shop for a house builder, I would stress. So there might not be a vast amount to go for there, but if income's purely your game, they have got the cash in the balance sheet to pay it. Now, the bigger dilemma possibly for the company is assuming it resolves this reputational problem quickly, which Bovis looks to have done a reasonable job of. If there is a housing downturn, when you're a house builder, what you generally should do is buy land when things are going wrong, because that sets you up for the next up cycle. So they could, in theory, have a debate between, do we pay the lavish divvy or do we buy land? So, but that, I think, is something for maybe 1 or 2 years down the road. But at the moment, bonkers as it looks, a 10% dividend yield when cash in the bank's earning you nothing, this one looks pretty safe right now. Capital-wise, they need to fix this reputation issue. And on the economy-wise, I think at the moment, you know, prices are flat, but the government's doing its best to support them.
Yeah. Do you know what? I was looking at the chart here.
It's not done much at all, has it, recently?
No. And the thing that strikes me is they've hit two highs in September 2017 and a year later in 2018, £29, right? Now, what strikes me is that last quarter four sell-off we had recently was such a big sell-off, because they went down to 18 quid. It's bounced back to like to
22
and now it's 22
there,
quid now. It's in between. They're basically in between the low of December and the high they rebounced to. So they were 25 quid, now they're back to 21. So they're in between that range. But I would suspect sentiment may drive them a bit lower, I think, for the time being.
Wouldn't surprise. I think because of this reputational thing, wouldn't surprise me at all. Didn't do Bovis any good. And eventually the new boss there, Fitzgerald, began to get his hands around it, and their customer ratings have improved again. And I think that's going to be a key short-term driver of sentiment towards the stock.
Yeah, and it's still under that 200-day moving average, which is seen as the bull bear.
Oh, you like that one, don't you? Yeah,
so
you're very keen on that one.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, any plans for the weekend, Russ?
It's a long weekend, 3-day weekend,
oh, yes.
just bobbling around the hometown of Brighton. I mean, to be fair, actually, sounds bad. I don't really like bank holiday weekends because I've got loads of deadlines and weeklies to write. So I have to do it in 4 days, not five. So
yeah.
Okay. I don't really want to, you know, I can work on bank holiday Monday, but I'm in my office and understandably the kids are saying, come on, don't be doing it. So I'm, you know, been working silly hours this week to try and get ahead of the game. But we've got kids have got to sleep over tomorrow night, so I'm cooking pizzas on the barbecue in the garden if the weather's any good, and if the weather's foul, it'll be Domino's time.
Nice.
Sunday we've got relatives for lunch, and then Monday, bit of bumbling around, and I've been roped into helping run my son's under 10 cricket team, so I'm helping with coaching there. What they're going to learn from me, 50-year-old, nearly 50-year-old with a bad back, is a separate issue altogether. But there's no shortage of enthusiasm.
Well, exactly. That's what I learned, Russ. Enthusiasm makes up for a lot. You know,
attitude rather than aptitude.
Exactly. Marvellous stuff, Russ. Have a nice weekend.
What about you? What are you up to?
Oh, listen, the wife is going to see Take That. I left for the kids.
Well, my sister did that a couple of weeks ago. She said she thought the boys were looking a bit jaded, actually. Maybe father time's catching up with them just like it is with me.
Yeah, time to sell. Run them by. Cool. And I'll be looking after the kids. We'll get up to something, no doubt. I'll be just separating them, fighting.
For 3 hours. There you go. That'll keep them quiet.
Exactly.
Sitting in the dark with a popcorn for 3 hours.
That's what we'll do. Yes. Well, do you know what? Exactly. Last week, I made the mistake that the wife said, book some tickets for the guy who's going to see a Dumbo. So he booked some tickets to Dumbo. And then I booked it, and I looked back and looked on Twitter, and Endgame Avengers were trending. And I thought, oh, no. So I went back, and I couldn't change my tickets. They said, no, unless you put that flexi saver pound option.
Yeah, you couldn't.
So at least now Endgame Avengers, because it's going to get cold on the weekend anyway, so we're going to see that. That's a 3-hour film. That'll take up 3 hours.
Exactly.
There we are. Lovely. Have a nice weekend, Russ.
Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. At five, Alien Metals. And the ticker is great. It's UFO. What is this? 1.86 million market cap. I'll have to look at this. It's just listed, is it? Or yesterday? Anyway, it's in the top five. Alien Metals, wow. At four, Bidstack. BIDS, still having a placing undergoing there, but should be finished surely before the weekend, hopefully. And then someone did say, where's the news on this company? Why are the news coming out? I said, well, because they've announced they're in the middle or could be doing a placing. So if that's happening, they won't be putting news out. But I assume news will be coming out after that. At three, 7 Digital Group, 7DIG, was up a lot this morning, but 100%, but down now to only just up 44%. At two, TP Group, and I think that's a company that features in that article, 3 AIM companies taking a slice of a $1 trillion defence spending pie, written by Abraham there. And at one, Zenith Energy, rose quite quickly yesterday, and then it had a pullback today, as they announced the placing. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are from the following companies. At five, Alba Mineral Resources, a Brockham update. At four, Management Resource Solutions, board changes. At three, Infrastrata, issues shares, director shareholding, and TVR. At two, Strategic Minerals, sales commence at Lee Creek Copper Mine, today. And number one, Angus Energy, Brockham Operations Update, of course, same as Alba Minerals. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, if you use the Vox Markets app, please give us a review if you haven't done so far. That way, when people search for investment apps, ours will pop up in the top search results. Thanks very much for that. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.